WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. We're living in a world where new technology spawns new products on a daily basis, and it's the job of my guest David Kelly to figure out how to make the designs for these products as user-friendly as possible. Kelly is the founder and CEO of IDEO, the largest product design firm in the country. IDEO designs more than 3,000 products a year. Its portfolio includes the first Apple mouse, the Crest stand-up toothpaste dispenser, and Nike's sleek sunglasses. The firm is also responsible for many of the latest internet appliances, like the electronic book. Now clients approach IDEO not only for product design, but also for help in designing a more innovative corporate culture. But for all the products out there that make you say, wow, there are others that make you say, whoa, a lot of the stuff that looks cool, once you get it home, you can't even figure out how to put in the batteries. I asked David Kelly what gives.
I think the people designing the products, most people in the world, are kind of sitting around the table thinking they're the experts on the toaster, and so they're the right ones to design the next toaster. So, they're the experts, so they should be able to do it. The problem is that experts use products in different ways than the average person does. And so they, in the old VCRs, it was okay to hold down two buttons and toggle three others in order to set the time and the date. And that's okay for the engineer who designed it because they're an expert. But it's not okay for my grandmother when she starts to try to record her favorite program next week. So the problem comes from the people designing products not having enough empathy for the behavior of actual people.
Let's talk about some of the products you've designed at IDEO that people use every day, or they could. You have a design for an office cubicle that looks like a car. Why don't you describe it for us?
That's the Q product. We call it the Q. Our design for this Office of the Future is like a little cart that has your computer and all your stuff on it. It has a motor in it. And so in the morning you come in, picture you come into a big space, and all these little carts are parked, all these little offices, in effect, are parked. And you jump on the one that you want. You put your identification card in, and all your computer stuff is loaded down, and you put all your little books and stuff on the shelf, so they're already there. And then you drive your office to where you want to be in the building. Let's say, I'd like to be by the windows today, so you drive by the windows. Or you say, I'd like to be over by Sally today, and so you talk to Sally, and you both drive your vehicles to the place you want to be. And so it's the easiest way to build teams and break down the offices so that you can be in the right team at the right time.
Sounds great. There's also a bumper car possibility there.
Yeah, in really creative groups, you'd probably have problems with people crashing into each other on purpose just for fun.
Well, when are we likely to ever see this product on the market or in our office?
I think what you're going to see next, the next step is, right now, companies tend to design their spaces for the individual. And if there's any space left over, then they'll build a conference room out of it. If there's a little space left over, then they can have a place where you can meet. I think what you're seeing more and more, at least in our client base, are people are focusing on the teams, that the problems are complex enough that they really believe that teams and that creative kind of multidisciplinary brainstorming that happens from people being together from different disciplines, kind of the interesting ideas come from the cracks in disciplines instead of right down the center. And so they're starting to design their offices with team space as the center. They focus primarily on building a great space for that team to work. And then after that, they build little spaces to have kind of touchdowns spaces for the individual. They also build what we call enclaves, special purpose places with nice chairs if you want to sit and read, or a small office with a couch and two chairs to have a small meeting. And so the end result is you get a team focused space. And so that then requires the individual spaces to be moved around a lot, depending on how the new teams are formed. And so I think the first step, instead of driving there, the first step will be that they'll be little touchdown spaces all around a team space.
Could you give us an example of a product that's coming out of this intersection of disciplines?
Yes. One of the products that I think is particularly interesting is a new product we've done for a company called HeartStream, which is a portable defibrillator. This is a product that we're trying to make it ubiquitous. It's everywhere. We're hoping that it will be everywhere. What it does is, if you have cardiac arrest, you really only have about 6 minutes before, you know, you have a really serious problem, like you're dead. And that's not long enough for an ambulance to get there. So what this is, you've seen the things on TV where, you know, they put the two paddles on, they say stand back, and they fire it. That's what this is. Only it's a portable unit, but its claim to fame is how easy it is to use, because you're going to have basically a naive user. It's in the back of an airplane. Somebody has a problem. You need to lay them on the floor, and then you have to figure out how to use this thing, which you've never used before. And it looks, you know, at least in the movies, it looks like it's technically difficult to understand. So the part that's multidisciplinary about this is that the people involved to design this are not just the engineers who do the circuitry, or the industrial designers that determine how the thing looks, or the marketing people that figure out how to sell it. There's also people like social scientists and people who understand usability of things, and that's kind of the most important thing in this kind of a product. So you study people and how they use it. Well, that's not a discipline that's normally a part of the mix in product design, or hasn't been in the past. So this product has a kind of a simple 1-2-3 way of using it that allows kind of anybody who would find it or need it when someone was having this kind of cardiac arrest problem, they would be capable of doing it and reviving the person.
Well, you designed the first Microsoft mouse, and in your offices, I saw that you have a 6 or 7 foot transparent tube filled with all of the prototypes that it took to make the mouse. There must be hundreds. Now, help me with this. It's a simple idea, right? A box on wheels, basically. What subtleties or intricacies am I missing?
Well, it's not clear, for instance, whether smaller is better. You know, when you use a mouse, sometimes you kind of rest your hand on the table, and you kind of a bar of soap feels like the right size. Sometimes for different tasks, you need to kind of just hold it in the tip of your finger. So a smaller mouse is better. So what we did was we actually made a whole bunch of prototype mice and gave them a maze game, which seemed appropriate for the mouse, which we like gave different shapes and different kind of technologies inside of the mouse and gave them to people and had them try out, and then measured which was the easiest one they could use to actually do different tasks and that would be normal in using a mouse. One of the funny things is when we first started doing mice, that we had to test how long they would. You know, how long you measure a mouse in miles to failure. So we take an old record player and put a record on it. We made records out of different types of desk material, you know, like a Formica desk or a wood desk or a glass, piece of glass on top of a desk. We make records out of that, and we put them on the turntable. And then we turn them on, and we knew it's 33 and a third. And then we'd tape the mouse to the tone arm of the record player, and then we'd sit it down on the record, and we'd see how long before it had a failure. So miles to failure is how you measure mice.
So how many miles to failure are there in a mouse?
It depends on what kind of material. You know, what happens is that, like, one of the things you have to do is, like, eraser junk off of the desk, you know, the little stray pieces of eraser get, like, inside the mouse and clog it up. And so we had to make the ball removable so you could take it out. People didn't like the sound of a metal ball on the tabletop, and so we had to coat the ball with rubber. And there's, you know, for a simple product, there seemed like there were thousands of little hurdles to get over. There's one thing that people kind of think, people like IDEO, design a product. The truth of the matter is we're designing the experience of using the product. You see what I mean? It's like the product itself is interesting, and so the engineers love to make the mechanism and design the circuits and all that kind of stuff. But what interests me the most is design the actual experience of using the product. So there's a lot of other things around that. You know, what your chair's like, and what the surface of the table's like, and what's happening on the screen. These are all things that affect your actual experience of using it.
What I imagine is interesting about designing for computers is that you're not only designing for use now, but you're really designing for use in the future. And one of your mantras, I know, for innovation is to live in the future. How do you realize that?
Yeah, that's it's like concepts cars. You know, if you went to the Detroit Auto Show, you'd see these cars that are about the future. You don't really expect to see them in the showrooms next month, but you start to see the direction that the car companies are going. You know, lots of fins or lots of swoopiness or, you know, 27 headlights across the front. Whatever it is, you start to see the direction it's going. And so that's what we try to do. We build these array rooms, we call them, of the future, whatever. If you're a kitchen appliance manufacturer, we build the future of the kitchen. If you're a company that does surgical equipment, we try to build the operating room of the future. And we get the people, especially the people who are in charge of running the company, the heads of marketing, the presidents, and those kind of people, to walk through the rooms or live in the rooms and try to understand, have a feeling of what it's going to be like in the future. Then once you've painted this, what we call scenario of the future, it's easier then as you're collecting information from places to see if that fits in with your direction.
I'm talking with industrial designer David Kelly. He's the founder and CEO of IDEO, which is the largest product design firm in the country. David, we're going to take a break now and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is industrial designer David Kelly. His firm, IDEO, has created award-winning designs for many Fortune 500s. David Kelly also teaches product design at Stanford University. At IDEO, you also teach workshops in innovation to corporations. And one recommendation that you make to companies who want to learn to be more innovative is to have a fun workplace. Now, what do your offices look like?
Our office has been described as more of a zoo than an office. But the important thing is to understand that playfulness is a part of creating. And so, you know, when I walk into a place where the offices look like a long hall with a bunch of closed doors or a sea of cubicles, I realize that it's going to be a hard task to help them with innovation. So our offices are... the most important thing is that they change all the time. Everything seems like an experiment. You know, we build this little team space with old plywood and furniture that we have, and then we learn that we need to improve it some way, and so we'll take it down and redo it. And the other thing that's obvious in a place that's good at innovating is that they tend to have the artifacts of the things that they do are all around, and they're proud of the things they do. So whether it's a magazine that has all of the latest issues torn apart and put up on the wall for you to read, or whether it's a product design firm that has old prototypes laying around, or a products good company that has movies of people using their product. The fruits of their work are kind of all around them because they're proud of that.
Apparently, a group of your young designers have a whole surplus airplane wing in their office.
Yeah. We're divided in what we call studios. There's about 20. We believe that size is very important on being innovative, and so we break the company down into what we call studios of no more than about 20, 25 people. And they get to, of course, do their own offices the way they think's the best way to do it. And so, yeah, so one of them came to me early on and said, you know, we really need a DC-3 wing in our office so that we can do our work. And I said, oh, well, yeah, of course. Sounds like that's what you need. So they took a Winnebago and all piled into and went down to Los Angeles somewhere. And there's a, you know, an airplane graveyard. And they came back with the DC-3 wing. And it's like bolted on the wall there.
Whatever it takes to get you through the night, right?
Right.
In teaching innovation, you stress the need to destigmatize failure. What does that mean, to destigmatize failure as part of a corporate culture?
Yeah, well, the thing about being innovative is it's risky. And so you really want to have people have a balance between having the kind of confidence to get their ideas out, and also, you know, questioning whether they're good ideas or not. You can't be too sort of arrogant and actually, you know, sort of think your idea is good all the time. On the other hand, you can't be kind of timid enough that you don't really want to get that idea out and have it see the light of day. So if you're always afraid that your idea is going to be rejected by the group or there's some penalty for coming out with it, then then you won't keep, you know, like keep the kind of juices flowing and keep coming up with things. There's a Stanford professor in organizational behavior, Bob Sutton, who's a colleague of mine, and he says the best thing to do is to reward success and failure equally and punish inactivity. And I think that's it. If you start to have failure or, you know, having a bad idea be punished, then you sort of people start doing less and less and less. And what you really want is people energized and coming up with ideas all the time. And so if the risk is low of coming up with an idea that doesn't work, then you'll come up with more and more ideas. And quantity is a big part of being innovative.
Where do you think then your designers are getting their ideas? And I read somewhere that there's a lot of toys around your offices, and people take things apart and put them back together again, and to be inspired.
Yeah, they certainly get their ideas from the hardware they tear apart. I mean, if you walk through our place, you know, it's an excuse to buy every product that comes on the market. I have to look at the budget on that. But what they do is they just buy everything and tear it apart, because there's kind of no excuse for reinventing something that already exists. So you want to kind of have a library of all the mechanisms and all the products and how everybody did everything. But the ideas are coming more and more from the observation of people using the product. So we have a division of the company called Skyline that designs toys. And the way they do it is they have play day on Thursday. And every Thursday, a whole bunch of kids come in and they play with the prototypes that they've done, or they play with existing toys. And we watch them and we see what they particularly like. Like, they particularly like bubbles, or they particularly like, you know, things that go fast and crash, or whatever it is they like. Then you start to realize, okay, you know, 3 to 5 year old kids, if that's who we have in the day, really like this, you know, this way, this thing kind of resonates with them. And we start designing a bunch of things that have that kind of characteristics. And then next Thursday, we show them to those kids when they come in. This is not so hard. You just, you know, you like see what works, and then you kind of iterate, and you eventually start to have things that people really fall in love with.
Industrial designer David Kelly is my guest. Were you the kind of kid who took everything apart and couldn't put it back together?
Yeah. In fact, this is a way I do admissions at Stanford. A kid comes in my office, says he wants to declare product design, and I say, tell me about yourself as a child. And if they say the word tinkerer, or if they talk about science projects as their favorite thing, then I know that that's the right kind of person to admit into the program. It's amazing how I'm still amazed. You can take things apart, you put them back together, you don't understand what happened, but when you put them back together, they work. And that's how you learn.
Did you design anything when you were a kid?
Design things all the time. Before there were tandem bikes, I thought I had this great idea where I'd take the bike, the wheel off the back of my friend's bike, and weld I take the wheel off the front of my bike and weld the forks to the back of my friend's bike. This is before tandem, so it would be really great. Unfortunately, going around some rough terrain, the weld on the forks broke, and one of us kind of went, you know, tasted a little dirt. But it was fun. I mean, I was like, you have these ideas. There's a feeling when you work, when somebody, you know, you go to these things and somebody says, what do you really enjoy? The thing I really enjoy is like being in the shop making things. You know, time kind of stands still for me when I'm actually, you know, in a shop, like, you know, making something and bolting it together. And that's, if you ask Stanford students who go through the product design program, and, you know, what do they miss about Stanford the most? They always say the same thing, the machine shop. They want access to a machine shop.
As a CEO, I can't imagine you have a lot of time to get your hands dirty. Is there something you'd really love to be in the machine shop designing right now?
Well, you know, for me, it's now moved more and more towards gifts, believe it or not. In this world, it's kind of hard if you're a designer and you kind of are intimate with every product that's on the market around the world. It's a little hard to figure out what to do as gifts, and you end up making things as gifts for people. So most of the time I'm in the shop these days. I mean, I go in the shop to watch what's being done for the company, in that I get invited in all these brainstormers about what's the right thing to do. Now, most of the young designers don't pay much attention to my ideas, but every once in a while, one will sneak in, and so I want to go into the shop and seeing it being made. But with 350 employees, it is kind of hard for me to spend much of the time in the shop. But in my personal life, I've built a little shop at home, and so you know, when it comes time to make a present for a best friend or whatever, instead of going out and buying something, you know, I find myself making it.
Can you tell us what you've made?
I've made all kinds of things, but the things I like to do tend to be like scaled up versions of something. So like a key, you know, I made this kind of key to happiness. Instead of being a little key that was, you know, 2 inches long, I made it, you know, 3 feet long, but perfectly detailed to be exactly like a key. you know, that would be on your key ring. And so it's people kind of like that feeling of having this kind of odd scaled thing to hang on the wall.
David Kelly, it was a lot of fun talking to you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
David Kelly's product design firm, IDEO, is based in Palo Alto.